ISU's loss yesterday busted a lot of brackets, including President Obama's. This hour, we'll speak with sports columnist Rick Brown about the two remaining Iowa teams' chances in the NCAA tournament. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Claire Roth. Also this hour, we'll discuss the Iowa company that's possibly defying state law by selling hemp oil, a new study that illuminates the connection between breakfast and learning outcomes, and just how expensive it is to get a public record from the government. Also, we'll speak with the state legislator who's trying to get craft beer growlers into your local convenience store. That's all coming up after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. On Friday, we do a News Buzz edition of the program, a series of quick conversations on the most interesting news of the week. Coming up later, we'll talk about the sale of hemp oil in the state. But first, the NCAA tournament started this week. And for the first time since 2005, all three state schools made it into the Division I tournament. Joining me now, Rick Brown, sports columnist for the Des Moines Register. Good afternoon, Rick.
Good afternoon.
How's the weather out in Seattle?
It's prototypical Seattle. Cloudy, 50s, and a few showers.
So let's start with yesterday's ISU game. The team was coming off a few really great games, two buzzer beaters, and then they were defeated by the 14th-seeded UAB. That busted a lot of people's brackets.
It busted a lot of people's brackets, from Cyclone fans all the way to the President of the United States. So, it was a tough loss. I can't say I was shocked just from the simple fact this team had been playing on the edge recently, and Coach Hoiberg had used the word burnout in discussing his team before the game, and I kind of got the feeling that's what happened.
And he said it was one of the hardest defeats he's ever been involved with.
Yeah, and this is a guy who has played at a high level from high school to college to the NBA and is now coaching at a high level. So when I heard him say that really, really took to heart what a tough loss that was for him personally and for his program.
Mm-hmm. The Hawkeyes play the Davidson Wildcats from North Carolina tonight. Five seasons ago, they won only 11 games. Moving on in the tournament would be a pretty big deal for head coach Fran McCaffrey. Are they expected to move on?
They're a slight favorite, and as a 7 seed, Davidson's a 10. I think Iowa's going to have to play very well to win this game. Davidson is experienced. They're a smaller team, but they shoot the ball really well, and they don't make a lot of mistakes. Third in the country in fewest turnovers, so Iowa's going to have to play very well. But Iowa has not won an NCAA game since 2001, so this would be a very positive step in the program if Iowa were to win this game.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit more about you and I. I know you're about to go to that game out in Seattle. They just came off their best season ever. What should we be expecting from them?
I think expect the same old, same old. This is the one team that has really played at a consistent level the entire season, 30-3 record, which is terrific. But they also have shown an ability to come back from behind, as they did in the conference tournament and beat Illinois State down double digits at halftime. But for the most part, it's a team that doesn't make a lot of mistakes, values possession of the ball. All five guys on the floor can score, so they're a tough matchup for opponents. And it's just very well coached. Ben Jacobson is a wonderful coach, and he's just got a program that's just rolling right now.
I was going to say, Ben Jacobson, he shared a letter, and it went somewhat viral on social media. It says, from the office of Ben Jacobson, UNI men's basketball, to whom it may concern, please excuse whoever from work on Friday, March 20th. I understand this absence may affect schoolwork and or workplace productivity, but I assure you it is for a very important reason. The UNI men's basketball team will be playing the Wyoming Cowboys at 12:40 p.m. in the NCAA basketball tournament. We need every member of Panther Nation to travel to Seattle or support us by watching us on TBS. It's safe to say that you and I is well-loved.
Well-loved. And really, when you think about it, this really is of the three teams. This is Iowa's true team with now 9 Iowans on scholarship. So that's the Iowa, Northern Iowa for sure. Ben is a down-to-earth guy. He's a terrific guy and a terrific basketball coach. He's he's a guy that is perfect for you and I, and hopefully they can keep him there for the rest of his career.
Mm-hmm. So ISU had a great season last year. Iowa's been steadily improving since McCaffrey's been in charge. And you and I, as we talked about, has had a few really great seasons. Is Iowa becoming a powerhouse state for college basketball?
Well, I mean, it's very odd to have all three playing at high level at the same time. As you mentioned in the intro, it's only the second time since 2005 all three have been in the tournament at the same time. But in 2005, all three barely were in the tournament. One was a 9 seed, one a 10 seed, and one 11 seed. This year, much different, a 3, a 5, and a 7, so or a 3, a 4, and a 7. So it's at the highest level it's ever been. It's going to be hard to sustain that, I think, just because Iowa State and Iowa play in power conferences. It's going to be hard to keep your head above water there. And then Northern Iowa, usually they reach his peak about every third year. He'll bring in a new group of kids and work them until they're seniors, and then they'll play at a very high level. So I think it might be asking too much to duplicate this every year, but I think people should surely enjoy it because it doesn't happen very often.
Hmm. Any other predictions for the Iowa teams as the tournament plays out?
You know, I think Northern Iowa has a great shot of making the Sweet 16. Wyoming today is obviously a tough matchup, and then they would possibly play Louisville, a team they played in the Bahamas a couple years ago and probably should have beat when Louisville was ranked number one in the country. That would be a fascinating matchup. I think the Panthers have the best chance of getting the Sweet 16. Iowa, if Iowa wins, they'll be facing probably second-seeded Gonzaga in its home state. So that will be a tough challenge, although Iowa's played very well on the road this year, so maybe that'll be a positive.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll all be following the UNI and Iowa games later today. Rick Brown is a sports columnist for the Des Moines Register. Thank you so much for joining us, Rick.
Thank you.
The UNI Panthers men's team will play the Wyoming Cowboys today in just a half hour in Seattle, Washington. You can watch the game on TBS and online and mobile devices free on the NCAA site. That's ncaa.com/March Madness Live. We'll also keep you updated on the score during news breaks on Iowa Public Radio. In a minute, I'll talk about the sometimes high cost of Iowa's open records requests. But first, let's hear a little bit of music in support of Iowa's Panthers. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. This week is Sunshine Week, which was created to promote access to public information nationwide. Anyone can request public records, but this type of access is particularly crucial for news organizations so that they can function as government watchdogs. Erin Jordan is a reporter for The Gazette and KCRG. She's been examining how expensive requests for public documents are, and she joins us in studio this afternoon.
Hi, Claire.
So, let's start off really basically. Who can take advantage of Iowa's open records law?
Really anyone. You know, these laws are written so that, you know, anyone from Iowa, but really you don't even have to be from Iowa, can request request public documents from government agencies, schools, clerks of courts, a variety of different public agencies.
And what's that process like?
Well, you know, you can do it formally. You can write a request, you know, that uses the legal language from Iowa Code Section Chapter 22, which is on open records. But, you know, you don't have to. The Iowa Attorney General's Office has issued opinions saying you can just ask for it verbally or send a quick email requesting those things. And agencies can't say, oh, well, I'm not going to provide it because it's not a formal request.
Okay. And how much does it typically cost?
Well, it really is across the board. You know, I've had lots of agencies, and to speak to their credit, who provide public records often for free. I feel like if agencies who are working in good faith, who are used to working with reporters, will try to get records fairly quickly, email them off to you. They know the law. They know what they're required to provide, and they don't hesitate to do so. And a lot of them will do it for free if they can do it, you know, fairly quickly.
So why are organizations being charged differently?
Well, you know, organizations, public agencies are trying to establish some rules so that their staff can be reimbursed for the time it takes them to compile public records requests. But, you know, some agencies have firm policies, others don't. You know, I talked to the University of Iowa, who has they've set a $30 per hour charge for compiling and providing public records requests. And that is after 1 hour free. So if they can gather stuff real quickly and email it to you, they won't charge you anything. But if it takes more than 1 hour, they're charging $30 an hour. And if you have a request that involves like database searching or extraction of data from a database, they charge you $75 an hour. So, you know, it's really just across the board.
So just to better understand the importance of this, can you give us an example of a Gazette story where access to public records was vital?
Sure. You know, there have been a lot of stories recently with the Iowa Board of Regents where, you know, the Gazette's reporter Vanessa Miller has been able to get access to some of these emails where it showed conversations between regents, kind of some of the back workings behind these, you know, like the funding model for the state universities, kind of finding out what the regents are saying behind the scenes and that sort of thing. I did a story a couple years ago looking at the wasted food at University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. And we were able to get that data to actually show, you know, that they had wasted X number of portions of, you know, spicy fries or whatever. And, you know, that was information we got through a public records request.
So recently, the Gazette tried to get data from the Cedar Rapids Community School District. What was the district's response?
Right. Well, this was not my request, but this was from Andrew Phillips, our education reporter. He had initially requested some summary data, policies, curriculum documents, and emails related to student discipline as a part of this ongoing federal investigation of racial disparities. So it's an important topic, and that's why he wanted to dig into it a little bit. So when they initially asked for it, the district came back and said it was going to cost $260,000.
Wow.
So yeah, you know,
that
I mean,
seems steep.
Yeah, you know, and I think a lot of people seeing that, you know, would think, well, that number is designed to make the requester go away. And I don't know what the case was. I don't know why they came out that high. But there then began some negotiations. And a lot of reporters believe that when you get a really big number, that's just a starting point, you know. But that's a pretty high starting point. So then Andrew and the Gazette worked with the district, and it came down to $83,000. And then, you know, of course, which is still ridiculous. And then they finally got it agreed on for pretty close to what Andrew initially asked for $740. Now, that's still a lot for a news organization, and a public person probably would not be able to pay that. But it was a lot more reasonable, and we felt like it was worthwhile for the data we could receive.
So did they give an explanation for their original quote and the disparity between their original quote and what they eventually agreed upon?
You know, I think there was something like, you know, this extracting this data is going to be so time consuming, and this is the hourly rate, and it's going to take us X number of hours. And, you know, I think it just ultimately didn't wash really, you know, when they were able to reduce it so substantially.
Mm. So there's talk of this being explicitly defined by the Iowa legislature in the next session. What are the chances of that happening?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, right now the code is so general, it just says a reasonable fee. And, you know, one person's reason is not another person's reason. So I think that it could stand some more definition. I think public records requests are so different that it would be hard to define it real specifically. But, you know, you've got a lot of people on this, you know, accountability experts and folks saying we need more, you know, both so the agencies are getting fairly reimbursed and so the requesters are, you know, not being dissuaded from from looking into our government by these really high costs.
So you mentioned at the start, anyone can make this type of request. What do you want people to know about open records requests? What do you want people to take away from Sunshine Week?
Right. Well, I think, you know, access to government is really important, and not just for news organizations, but for anyone. And if you look at the agenda for the Iowa Public Information Board, you can see that there's a variety of people who are looking for this stuff. Maybe they feel like they were unfairly fired from a, you know, government agency, and they want to see what some of the back dealings were. Maybe they feel like they didn't get a contract that they should have gotten, and they want to find out more about that. So there's it really provides a way for citizens to just check into things with our government, make sure it's operating fairly, and you know, treating people above board.
Right. Well, Erin Jordan is a reporter for the Gazette and KCRG. She's been examining how expensive requests for public documents are. Thank you so much for joining us, Erin.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. Cannabis oil, an extract of marijuana plants, has been a hot topic in the Iowa legislature in the last few years. Now, a company in Iowa, Heartland Hemp, is selling hemp oil and possibly defying state law in the process. Tony Lays, health reporter for the Des Moines Register, has been following the story and joins us now. Good afternoon, Tony.
Hi, Claire.
So before we talk about Heartland Hemp specifically, let's discuss the law. In terms of cannabis oil, what is and isn't allowed in the state of Iowa?
Well, it's hard to get a straight answer about that. But the law that was passed last spring allows possession by people who have intractable epilepsy. But the law didn't really provide a way for it to be distributed or purchased or sold.
So what exactly is Heartland Hemp doing?
What they're doing is buying an oil that they say is produced from hemp that's legally imported from Europe. It's related to marijuana, but they say it's not marijuana. And it is a product that is mainly used for making like cloth or rope or things like that. But they say that this variety is very high in CBD, which is the ingredient that folks want to use for medical purposes often, but doesn't have very much THC, which is the chemical that makes people high. And it is taken from that product imported from Europe and turned into this oil by a California company. And then the Heartland Hemp is then buying it from the California company and reselling it to people in Iowa.
So is this convoluted process of ingredients in Europe, processing in California, shipping to Iowa, is that the only way to get cannabis oil into Iowa at the moment?
Well, they say it's the only legal way, but I can't get a straight answer as to whether it's really legal. I talked to state officials who punted on the question and said it's really not their role to tell people whether it's legal. And I talked to a spokesman for the federal DEA. She told me that she doesn't believe it's legal, but even she said it's a gray area. So it's hard to say.
So if it's not the state's authority to tell, is it the DEA's? Whose job is it to say if it's illegal or not?
That's the question. So if you're a consumer, it's not clear what you're supposed to do here. The DEA did say that they're not really interested in going after individual consumers, but they left open the question of whether they could prosecute someone for selling this.
So the owner of Heartland Hemp, Boris Schransky, is saying that sales aren't subject to the state's new limited medical marijuana law, so customers don't even need those registered state-issued cannabis oil cards. What's his reasoning behind that?
He says it's not marijuana.
Okay.
So that it's a legal product that you can buy just like you can buy hemp seeds in a health food store, which some people do. So he says it's not marijuana. You don't need a card. And, you can't get a straight answer as to whether that's really true from state officials.
Hmm. Schransky's also very careful to not claim that it cures any particular illness. Why is that?
Well, the FDA sent out warning letters recently to several companies nationally that were selling CBD oil and were making specific claims. It warned them that they shouldn't be doing this. They're selling it as a supplement, not really as a drug. And this is an issue that comes up with supplements. You probably have seen those disclaimer lines about how this product is not supposed to treat or diagnose any specific disease. Supplements are not nearly as closely regulated as prescription drugs are, and they're not supposed to be claiming that they can cure any specific condition. When you read some of the ads for supplements, you can see that they're really skirting that line, though.
The production of this oil is not the only issue at play here. It's also who can access it, because right now it's just those with epilepsy. Is that correct?
Right.
So who are the other groups that are pushing for it?
Oh, there's a lot of them. There's cancer, MS. There's folks with PTSD. And they're not just pushing for the oil. They're, some of them are pushing for other types of marijuana to be legalized too. So there's a lot of interest in it from different groups.
The rise in use of medical marijuana seems to be rising in conjunction with frustration and skepticism of pharmaceuticals and the bigger pharmaceutical companies. Where do you see the tension in terms of alternative medicine and pharmaceuticals in this debate? When you look at, for instance, these people selling hemp oil and saying, oh, it's just a supplement, and not definitively claiming science on their side, or at least claiming that it will solve their problems, you know, on the package.
That's definitely part of the tension. There are pharmaceutical versions that are being tested, including there's one that's being tested. It's going to start soon at the University of Iowa in kids with epilepsy. And, you know, there are some folks in the medical marijuana community who are a little leery of that because they don't think it should be in the hands of the pharmaceutical companies. On the other hand, those studies should provide much more definitive answers as to whether this works compared to the anecdotal stories that people hear from Colorado and from places like that.
Hmm. You spoke with state lawmaker Representative John Forbes. He's an Urbandale Democrat who works as a pharmacist. He sponsored a bill that would have legalized hemp production in Iowa, but it didn't pass.
Right. There are several states that do allow it. There's talk of making it an economic development issue that you could raise hemp here. The concern is that that would open the door for folks who are really trying to grow marijuana. The hemp supporters say that you could easily tell the difference and that it wouldn't lead to more marijuana, but that is the holdup.
Well, and Representative John Forbes isn't the only one who's pushing it. Christian conservative leader Bob Vanderplaats just came out in favor of the legalization of cannabis oil production. Is this bipartisan? It seems like those are odd bedfellows.
It does. Mr. Vanderplaats has a son who possibly could benefit from it, I think, is part of what led him to think about it. It's an interesting issue. It does cross lines. I mean, there are folks who are libertarians who are some of the strongest supporters. Rand Paul supports legalization. So it's not strictly a Republican-Democrat issue.
Given the tentativeness of the government to say whether what Heartland Hemp is doing is legal or not, do you think there will be a crackdown on Heartland Hemp or no?
I didn't hear anybody raring to go raid them, or certainly not raring to go arrest people who are buying from them. It's hard to tell. I mean, the Obama administration has said they don't want to interfere with people who are following the law in states that have medical marijuana, which to me says they really don't want to get involved in this. They're trying to stay out of it as best they can. So on the other hand, though, that's not a guarantee. You don't know for sure what they are going to do.
Tony Lays is a health reporter for the Des Moines Register. He's been following the cannabis oil story. Thank you again for joining us, Tony.
Thanks, Claire.
Coming up in the second half of the program, we'll talk to a University of Iowa researcher about the importance of school breakfast to the learning outcomes of low-income kids. And we'll speak with State Senator Jeff Danielson about whether you might be able to get a growler and fill up your favorite craft beer at your local convenience store. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth. Join us in the second half of the hour. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. It used to be that your only choices when it came to buying eggs were medium, large, or extra large, or whether you wanted a half dozen or a full dozen. But with an increased focus on food production, those choices are becoming more complicated. Hongwei Shin is a distinguished professor of agricultural and biosystems engineering, and he's the director of the Egg Industry Center at Iowa State University. He's conducted a study that details the trade-offs egg producers face in modern farming, and he's with us now. Good afternoon, Hongwei.
Good afternoon to you.
So before we get into the details of the study, can you explain what the motivation behind it was?
Well, there is lacking information in terms of different egg production systems, especially on the commercial scale. in the United States. And so there's need for consumers and the retailers in terms of the characteristics of different production systems, and especially looking at a holistic view of different sustainability components.
So what were the major factors you considered when you set off to find the impact of these different egg production methods?
That's right. We're looking at five components of the sustainability areas, namely animal welfare, well-being, egg quality and safety, the environment, food affordability, and worker health and safety.
Okay. So which chicken settings did you study? What were you looking at as far as control groups, test groups, et cetera?
That's right. So we're looking at three housing systems, conventional cage and enriched colony and an aviary housing systems. And all three housing systems are located at the same farm, so with the same genetics bird, the same age, and similar management crew.
Okay. And so how'd you examine them? What'd you test for? What'd you look at?
Again, we're looking at a five component of sustainability. And animal well-being, welfare, egg quality, environment, affordability, worker health. So going through two flocks of production, and which cover essentially 3 years, and it's a multi-state and multidisciplinary, as you could imagine, because the complex nature, we require people with different expertise. And I myself was in charge of the environmental component, but then other folks from other universities, Michigan State, UC Davis, USDA ARS, they're in charge of other components of the study.
And so, you know, when you were literally examining them, you used something called Trudy, is that right?
That's correct. Trudy is a name we gave to our mobile air emission monitoring lab, which we use to gather data on the environment component, measure the indoor air quality, air emissions, ventilation rate, and energy use, and plus the data acquisition system.
Okay, so let's talk about, you know, the results of the study. Looking at the environmental aspects first, what was the impact of each of those settings on the environment?
Well, looking at the three housing systems, as I said, there are trade-offs, so environment is no exception. We're looking at, you know, for example, the aviary housing system, which gave the bird a lot of freedom to move about inside the house. However, because of that, the bird's natural behavior of dust bathing generated quite a bit of a dust. And because the litter accumulation in the house also created some ammonia issues in the wintertime when the ventilation is low. So the air quality in general is not as good in the aviary housing system as compared to the cage, enriched colony or conventional cage system. And also as a result, the aviary housing then will emit more dust to the environment.
So do the findings of the study pit animal welfare and environmental concerns against each other?
Well, once again, there's a trade-off. In this case, as I said, the aviary provide the most animal movement, and followed by the enriched colony where the birds do have enriched elements, for example, perches, a scratch pad, and nest box, and more room to move around inside the colony. And so from that standpoint, they do have more freedom to express their natural behavior. However, the environment, as I said, the air quality, it could be a concern for the aviary. Now, the enriched colony, the air quality is very similar to the conventional cage system.
Turning to economics, what were the settings' impact on egg output?
One of the things with the aviary, for example, is the higher mortality that we see in this study. As a result, the birds in that particular housing system then lay less number of eggs. And, of course, with the more complex the system, less birds that could be accommodated with the system, then you have a higher cost of production. That's true with the aviary as well as with the enriched colony. Particularly the aviary, we're looking at about 36% higher in the cost of production, whereas for the enriched colony, that's about 13%, based on analysis of the economists on the project.
So is that why cage-free eggs are often about a buck more at the grocery store?
That would make sense because the cost of production is higher. That's correct.
Okay. So the results of the study, they've already been published in 3 articles in the first wave of 9 publications, you know, just in the March issue of the Journal of Poultry Science. What do you anticipate the reaction will be from industry insiders?
So those 9 articles actually all came from the same study. It happens that 3 of the articles came from the researchers at Iowa State dealing with the housing systems, indoor air quality, and air emissions. So our role for the study is really to present the science-based information for the stakeholders, producers, suppliers, and the users to make their own judgment. And based on these trade-offs, they can say, here's my need. I view this more important than the others, whether it's animal welfare or food affordability or the environment. And different people may put in a different weight. So it is up to the end user themselves to really to make the decision then as they look into a different production systems or egg supply.
Well, again, thank you so much for joining us. We have just been talking with Hongwei Shin. He's a distinguished professor of agricultural and biosystems engineering and the director of the Egg Industry Center at Iowa State University. He's conducted a study that details the trade-offs of egg producers face in modern farming. Thank you again, Hongwei.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
So glad to have you with us on this News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has a school breakfast program that offers subsidized breakfast to some low-income students. A new study from the University of Iowa has further demonstrated the efficacy of that program. David Frisvold is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Iowa, and he's with us now. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. So just to start, tell us a little bit about the study. How'd you conduct it?
Sure. I was looking at schools that offered the breakfast program, and I was comparing student outcomes in those schools to student outcomes in the schools that did not offer the breakfast program. And I was trying to compare students in otherwise similar schools. And so I was looking at schools in states that require relatively high poverty schools to offer the program. And what happens is many states have thresholds where if there are, say, at least 25% of the student body that is eligible for free or reduced price lunch, then the school is also required to offer breakfast.
Okay.
And so I was comparing students in schools that were just required to students in schools that just were not required.
So tell us a little bit more about those findings. How significant was that gap?
So what I found was that basically over the course of elementary school, there would be about a 25% increase in math achievement scores. And so this was a cumulative impact. So there would be a small increase each year that accumulates over time throughout the course of elementary school and leads to a significant increase in math scores. And reading as well. The reading findings were actually quite similar.
So I know that the answer to this feels intuitive, but any conjectures on what made the difference and why that happened, why the results turned out the way they did?
So one reason could have been simply that because breakfast is available prior to the start of the school day, you're more likely to attend school, or it makes it so that you're more likely to be on time for your first class. I found that that didn't really seem to be the case that was driving the results. Instead, it seemed to be coming through more from a nutrition story. So the idea was that it's not really the idea that the nutritional content of breakfast available, and then is in an absolute sense is wonderful. The idea is that it's better in a relative sense than what students would have eaten otherwise.
So a Pop-Tart at home versus an egg at school.
Yeah, but it's not really just a, think more in terms of like a Pop-Tart and a soda. And so switching from a Pop-Tart and a soda to egg and milk.
You know, this is pretty classic wisdom. You know, our mom's yelling at us to get something in our stomachs before we take a test, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
Why are studies like this necessary?
So there's been a lot of work related to breakfast, to different types of school feeding programs. But in terms of the school breakfast program itself, there'd basically been one study a couple decades ago that really looked at this as well. And what's interesting is that when President Johnson launched the program, one of the things that he said was he was launching the program to improve student achievement. But there hadn't actually been a lot of work to understand if that was the case. And there's reasons why the school breakfast program might differ, or the impact of the school breakfast program might differ from other studies that assess the benefits of a quality breakfast. And some of the critiques could have been about the quality of the breakfast. And so what this study is showing, though, is more that the availability of the breakfast makes it so that what students are eating at school compared to what they would have eaten otherwise is leading to important school, important gains for students throughout school.
Can you give us an idea of the scope of this program?
So it's expanded over time. It's about a $3 billion program that about 13 to 14 million students receive breakfast from. And it's available in around 90% of schools across the country now. So it's expanded substantially in different periods of time. In the early 90s, it expanded substantially and has been expanding gradually since then. So that it's available now in almost every school.
Your study illuminates the positive outcomes of this program. The obvious drawback is cost. Are there any other possible economic gains, maybe in the long term, from this program?
The long run gains are going to stem in many ways from the education gains. So boosts to academic outcomes for elementary school have been shown to be related to some of the long-run things we might care about related to labor market outcomes or graduating from high school. And so the cost would be the $3 billion. The gains are going to be seen more in the future from improvements in educational attainment and longer run labor market outcomes.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me today, David.
Well, thank you very much.
David Frisvold is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Iowa. His paper, Nutrition and Cognitive Achievement of the School Breakfast Program, will be published in the upcoming issue of the Journal of Public Economics. Thanks again, David.
Thank you.
So glad to have you with us today on River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition today, where we do a series of quick conversations on the most interesting news of the week. A bill has been introduced in the Iowa legislature that would allow convenience and grocery stores to purchase draft beer and sell it to customers in to-go containers, or growlers. Senator Jeff Danielson is the sponsor of the bill, and he joins me now. Good afternoon, Senator.
It's good to be with you.
When you were first considering this bill, what need did you see not being met? What was the main motivation when you first thought of it?
Well, there's tremendous demand for what I call a more personal experience in the beer industry, and it's being met by the craft industry, right? People like different flavors. They're actually more brand loyal, and especially if they know it's local and Iowa made. What we have seen over the last couple of years is those establishments have been very successful in their own neck of the woods, but that customers from more distant parts of Iowa or even the Midwest are demanding that product when they want it, whether or not they're there locally at the time. And so we have seen a lot of requests for changes in our alcohol laws to make that product more widely available.
What specifically does this bill do?
So what it does is it honors Iowa's current three-tier system, the separation of manufacture, distribution, and retail sale of alcohol by allowing growlers, which is a new phrase for me, by the way, to be available in Class C liquor license establishments, basically your convenience stores. Customer comes in, pours the beer into the container. It is sealed up in a way that it complies with open container laws and then can be transported back to the home.
So just to make sure that our audience is on the same page as you, can you describe what a growler is for us?
So a growler is a refillable container. I actually saw a couple last week. They were glass, and in this case, they have a metal twist-on lid that's resealed after the product is poured in. And so there are two goals. One, to make sure that the product itself, the craft beer, if you will, is available on site with Class C liquor licenses. That would be new for Iowa. And then secondly, once you leave the establishment, are you still in compliance with open container laws because of the way in which it's been sealed up? And we think we've achieved both of those goals in the bill.
So what type of support does this have in the Senate?
Well, out of my committee, it received broad bipartisan support. Keep in mind that we're dealing with alcohol policy and a lot of moral components to that. And so we need a higher level of scrutiny. We don't allow free and unfettered use of alcohol. This isn't a toy from China that you buy from Walmart, right? So we have a long history of a three-tier system, which ensures that the manufacturer, distribution, and retail sale are all done appropriately by license holders that have to follow rules so that we can manage the downsides of a product like alcohol, but still allow it for its lawful use.
And does this law exclude brew pubs?
Yes.
Why is that?
Currently, well, because of the three-tier system. Keep in mind, this is alcohol. It's not, as I said, a toy from China that you buy off the shelf at Walmart. People have very strong feelings about alcohol, and it's in society's best interest to ensure that we manage both the costs and benefits of alcohol availability. And so we're not in an environment where people want free and unfettered access to alcohol. Brew pubs are a new business model that is emerging. There's relatively few of them in Iowa, but they are important to their communities, and they offer another choice. That is a specialty beer that's usually made locally that people tend to have a more emotional attachment to than the other products. But currently, they are not allowed to package for a retail sale.
So since growlers could be bought at gas stations under this bill, is there any concern out there that about drinking and driving?
Well, that's really the overriding reason we take a limited, responsible, thoughtful approach to any new trends that we see in the alcohol industry. And certainly, we think there's a benefit to the craft beer industry. There are Iowans who are creating jobs, and there are also Iowans who are creating demand for that product. But it can't be free and unfettered because of the history that we know of alcohol being available. And so, you know, as long as I'm chair of the committee, when we look at this issue and we're offered the sort of new ideas on how to make alcohol more available, I always have to exercise an abundance of caution for what we are willing to say yes to. In this case, craft beer makers can provide their product to the distributors, who will then make it available in the retail outlets. And we think it actually creates a new market, but does it in a way that honors the time-honored tradition of safety and not encouraging free and unfettered access to alcohol.
Okay, before we let you go, I have to ask, are you a big local beer fan?
I drink a beer every once in a while. I'm a firefighter back home, career firefighter, so I understand the downside to drinking and driving. Always do it responsibly. And actually, rum and Coke sits better with me, so that's usually my drink of choice.
Okay, well, thank you again for joining us, Senator.
You're welcome. Anytime. We appreciate you spending time on this issue. It's very important to a lot of Iowa.
Senator Jeff Danielson is the sponsor of a bill that would allow convenience and grocery stores to purchase draft beer and sell it to customers in to-go containers. Thanks again, Senator.
You're welcome.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River is always available at iowapublicradio.org. And we always welcome your comments and questions about the program. Contact us at any time at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Claire Roth. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us.